And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we have all kinds of interesting things going on. But before I get started, I want to talk to you about some folks I have discovered. Absolutely. Now, I've been in the legal field one way or another for, 40 years. I've run into crooked judges. I had a career ruined because I told a judge I wasn't going to violate my promise to a client. And some of the most difficult people to deal with are what were referred to in the media as process servers. And Texas has a certification for process servers. And a company that was founded in 2007, and the gentleman I'm dealing with is a former Marine, is known as Cherokee Process Servers. And the reason they formed their company was to give the consumer more information about the process service process. And they perform a wide variety of services. Now, I just filed. For 7 years, I have been involved in a legal case that has plumbed the depths of things you only read about in the movies or in books and see in the movies. I've had an attorney take a payoff. I've had a judge take a payoff. Because these folks are wonderful people who started this. Now, they're not, Cherokee Process Services are not attorneys. They don't pretend to be. But they will explain to you very clearly what the process service actually is. Now, Texas, December 30th, 2020, the Texas rules allow electronic service. But the jury's still out on whether that means the initial petition can be served. And since some of the people that I'm suing in this thing are actually attorneys who've conspired with their clients, it raises a very key issue. But, among the services is they serve the petitions and summons. They serve eviction notices, subpoenas, temporary orders, show cause orders. They have a mobile notary. I mean, this is a full-service firm that can give you any assistance that you need short of what would be done by an attorney. And quite frankly, most attorneys, if you shake their hand, check your watch and ring when you take your hand back. All that having been said, I cannot give these folks high enough of a rating. They're just good people. And in the legal profession, that is sometimes hard to find. All that having been said, and if you've listened to my show often, I don't talk about many, I guess you can call it ads. But I give these folks my highest rating. Well, then this is April 16th, the 106th day of the year. 259 days until the year is over with. On this day in history, in AD 73, the Jewish fortress of Masada falls to the Romans after several months of siege. It ends the first Jewish-Roman war. In 1346, Stefan Dušan, also known as the Mighty, is crowned emperor of the Serbs at Skopje. His empire occupies much of the Balkans. 1520, the revolt of the Comuneros begins in Spain against the rule of Charles V. Now, the revolt of the Comuneros was actually an uprising by citizens of Castile against the rule of Charles and his administration. At its height, the rebels controlled the heart of Castile. They controlled the cities of Valladolid, Tordesillas, and Toledo. Now, there was a lot of political instability in regard to the crown of Castile after the death of Queen Isabella in 1504. Her daughter Joanna succeeded to the throne, but everyone said Joanna was mentally unstable, so a group of nobles and her father, King Ferdinand II of Aragon, actually ruled in her stead. Well, Ferdinand died in 1516, and Joanna's 16-year-old son, Charles, became king of both Castile and Aragon. Charles, though, had been raised in the Netherlands and didn't know anything at all about Castilian. And when he came to Spain in October 1517, he had a large retinue of Flemish nobles and clerics. So there was a great deal of mistrust, I guess you could say, between the new king and the Castilian elite. In 1582, Spanish conquistador Hernando de Lerma founds the settlement of Salta in Argentina. 1746, the Battle of Culloden, fought between the French-supported Jacobites and the British Hanoverian forces commanded by William Augustus, Duke of Cumberland. Battle, of course, took place in Scotland. After the battle, many Highland traditions were banned and the Highlands of Scotland were cleared of inhabitants. And they made them wear pants. 1780, Franz Friedrich Wilhelm von Fürstenberg founds the University of Munster. 1799, French Revolutionary War. Battle of Mount Tabor. Napoleon drives Ottoman Turks across the River Jordan near Accra. 1818, U.S. Senate ratifies the Rush-Bagot Treaty, limiting naval armaments on the Great Lake and Lake Champlain. 1847, shooting of a Maori by an English sailor results in the opening of the Whanganui campaign of the New Zealand Wars. 1853, the Great Indian Peninsula Railway opens the first passenger rail in India, from Borybunder to Thane. 1858, the Wernerian National History Society, former Scottish Learned Society, is wound up. 1862, American Civil War, battle at Lee's Mill in Virginia. Also in 1862, during the American Civil War, the District of Columbia Compensated Emancipation Act was a bill ending slavery in the District of Columbia, and it became law on this date. 1863, during the Vicksburg Campaign, gunboats commanded by Acting Rear Admiral David Dixon Porter run downriver past Confederate artillery batteries at Vicksburg. 1881, in Dodge City, Kansas, Bat Masterson fights his last gun battle on this date. He eventually went to New York, became a sports writer, and died of a heart attack sitting at his desk. He didn't die with his boots on. He died with his dress shoes on. 1908, Natural Bridges National Monuments established in Utah. 1910, the oldest existing indoor ice hockey arena still used for the sport in the 21st century, the Boston Arena, opens for the first time on this date. 1912, Harriet Quimby becomes the first woman to fly an airplane across the English Channel. 1917, Vladimir Lenin returns to Petrograd, Russia from exile in Switzerland. And that was the beginning of the end for the Romanov dynasty. 1919, Mohandas Gandhi organizes a day of prayer and fasting in response to the killing of Indian protesters in the Jallianwala Bagh massacre by the British colonial troops 30 days before. 1919, Polish-Soviet War. Polish Army launches the Vilna Offensive to capture Vilnius in modern Lithuania. 1922, the Treaty of Rapallo, pursuant to which Germany and the Soviet Union reestablished diplomatic relations, is signed. 1925, during the communist St. Nedelya church assault in Sofia, Bulgaria, 150 are killed and over 500 are wounded. 1941, World War II, the Italian-German Tarigo convoys attacked and destroyed by British ships. Also in 1941, the Nazi-affiliated Ustasi put in charge of the independent state of Croatia by the Axis powers after Operation 25 is effected. Now, Operation 25 was the invasion of Yugoslavia, also called the April War. It was a German-led attack on the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, which began April 6, 1941. The order for the invasion was put forward in Fuhrer Directive No. 25, which was issued March 27th, following a Yugoslav coup d'etat that overthrew the pro-Axis government. Okay. 1942, King George VI awarded the George Cross to the people of Malta in appreciation for their heroism. 1943, Albert Hofmann accidentally discovered the hallucinogenic effects of the research drug LSD. He intentionally takes the drug 3 days later on April 19th. 1944, Allied forces start bombing Belgrade, kill about 1,100 people. The bombing took place on the Orthodox Christian Easter. 1945, the Red Army begins the final assault on German forces around Berlin, with nearly 1 million troops fighting in the Battle of the Silo Heights. 1945, U.S. Army liberates Nazi Sonderlager, prisoner of war camp Auflag 4C, better known as Koditz. 1945, more than 7,000 die when the German refugee ship Goya sunk by a Soviet submarine. 1947, an explosion on board a freighter in port causes the city of Texas City, Texas, to catch fire. Almost 600 people die. 1947, Bernard Baruch first applies the term Cold War to describe the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. 1961, in a nationally broadcast speech, Cuban leader Fidel Castro declares he's a Marxist-Leninist and that Cuba's going to adopt communism. 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. pens his letter from Birmingham jail while incarcerated in Birmingham, Alabama. He's been incarcerated for protesting against segregation. 1972, the Apollo program, the launch of Apollo 16 from Cape Canaveral in Florida. 1990, Dr. Death Jack Kevorkian participates in his first assisted suicide. 2001, India and Bangladesh began a 5-day border conflict, unable to resolve the disputes about their border. 2003, the Treaty of Accession signed in Athens, admitting 10 new member states to the European Union. 2007, Virginia Tech shooting. Sing-Hui Cho guns down 32 people and injures 17 more before committing suicide. 2012, the trial for Anders Behring Breivik, perpetrator of the 2011 Norway attacks, begins in Oslo, Norway. 2012, the Pulitzer Prize winners were announced. First time since 1977, no book won the fiction prize. 2013, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake strikes Sistan in Baluchistan province in Iran, kills at least 35 and injures 117 more. 2013 Baga massacre started when Boko Haram militants engaged government soldiers in Baga. 2014, the South Korean ferry MV Sewol capsizes and sinks near Jindo Island, kills 304 passengers and crew and leads to widespread criticism of the South Korean government, media, and shipping authorities. It was vastly overloaded. Okay. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Christian Feast Day, Benedict Joseph Labri, Bernadette Subirius, Drogo, Fructuosus of Braga, Isabella Grillmore in the Church of England, Martyrs of Zaragoza, Molly Brandt in the Anglican Church of Canada in the Episcopal Church, Toribius of Astorga, birthday of Jose de Diego in Puerto Rico in the U.S., birthday of Queen Marguerite II in Denmark, Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C., Memorial Day for the Victims of the Holocaust in Hungary, National Health Care Decisions Day in the U.S., Remembrance of Chemical Attack on Balasan and Sheikh Wasan in the Iraqi Kurdistan, and World Voice Day. All right. Let's see what else we have. In 1457 B.C., the Battle of Megiddo. Egyptian forces under Thutmose III defeat a large Canaanite coalition under the King of Kadesh. This is the first battle recorded with a reliable account. 1178 B.C., a solar eclipse may have marked the return of Odysseus, legendary king of Ithaca, to his kingdom after the Trojan War. 556, Pelagius I begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 1071, Barre falls to Robert Guiscard, ends Byzantine rule of Italy. 1346, now that was Stephen Urals the IV, Dusan the Mighty. 1395, Azzo d'Este is defeated at the Battle of Porto Maggiore by Venetian Ferrarese troops. 1509, the French army under Louis XII enters the Alps. 1521, Martin Luther arrives at the Diet of Worms assembly. 1632, Albrecht von Wallenstein appointed supreme military commander of the Holy Roman Empire. 1705, Queen Anne of England knights Isaac Newton at Trinity College in Cambridge. 1746 was historically the last battle on British soil. And when Charles Stuart's troops were defeated, that pretty much ended his pretending to the throne. 1789, George Washington heads out for his first presidential inauguration. 1797, the Spithead Mutiny begins. British Royal Navy sailors protest living and working conditions and their pay near Portsmouth. 1854, San Salvador is destroyed by an earthquake. 1854, the steamer Long Beach sinks off Long Beach in New York. 311 die. 1861, President Lincoln outlaws businesses working with the Confederate States. He called it treason. 1862, the Confederate Congress approves the Conscription Act for all white males, 18 to 35. 1865, Battle of Columbus and West Point in Georgia. That's Fort Tyler. Union forces won one of the last battles of the U.S. Civil War. Interestingly enough, the cannons that were emplaced around Columbus were thrown in the Chattahoochee River. Some friends and I were explored that. 1866, nitroglycerin explodes at a Wells Fargo and Company office in San Francisco. Shattered glass for half a mile. 1869, Ebenezer Bassett, the first African-American diplomat, begins his service as minister to Haiti. 1870, the Vaudeville Theater, known as the Strand, opens in London. 1874, Dr. David Livingston, physician and explorer, his body arrives in Southampton. 1883, Paul Kruger, chosen as president of Transvaal. He's the third president of the South African Republic. 1900, on this date, the U.S. Post Office issues its first book of postage stamps. It's just absolutely amazing how many people call me the moment I go live on my show. Well, we've been talking about the wide world of weird. And I've got some more stories for today. Now, if you ever saw Poltergeist, little girl Carol Ann introduced most of America to the concept of Poltergeist. That took place in 1982. But the stories about Poltergeist, which is German for noisy ghost, actually go back centuries. One of the earliest recorded cases of Poltergeist haunting took place in Bingen on the Rhine in 858 A.D. According to a chronicle entitled Annals Fodense, this particular poltergeist is known for its stone-throwing habits, and it also liked to set fires. And it made walls shake as if they were being pounded on by hammers. Now, flying stones, shaking buildings, even spontaneous fires have all been connected with poltergeist cases over the years. But the entity referred to as the Banger in Bingen took it a step further. It also said to shout at people. Now, the focal point, if you will, of this particular entity was a farmer whose crops had been burned by the spirit just after it had been harvested. And he was denounced loudly by the spirit for a variety of embarrassing acts, including fornication and adultery. Case got so bad, the Bishop of Maine sent a group of priests to exorcise the ghost. However, all attempts at exorcism failed, and the Rhineland farmer continued to be plagued by this angry entity. What got it all fired up, nobody seems to know. But from the Rhine, or the Rhine, if I can talk, let's talk about X-Files on the Emerald Isle. Now, freedom of information laws are just absolutely wonderful things when the folks that have to release the information don't lie. They let us eventually learn about all those weird things our various governments would prefer to keep hushed up behind closed doors. And thanks to the freedom of information laws on the Emerald Isles, one of the most recently released nuggets of information is the fact that the Defense Force of Ireland have kept a secret dossier on UFOs for over 37 years. Now, the dossier was declassified in May of 2007 and contains reports going back to 1947. That's the same year that in the U.S. a flying saucer was believed by many to have crashed in a desert near Roswell, New Mexico. I used to talk there until it became politically unpopular to outsell a man who thinks he's God's gift to the UFO community, Don Smith. According to Irish ministry officials, the dossier had been closed since 1984. Of course, conspiracy theorists might well maintain in another 30 or 40 years the freedom of information laws will bring about the disclosure of more recent projects devoted to tracking and analyzing this persistent phenomenon. Now, the Irish sightings include two extraordinary events in 2001. First, a flying craft trailing smoke was seen to crash in Benoglen Mountain near Kinaway in February 2001. Now, no known aircraft went down in that area. They never revealed what actually did go down. On August 28th of that year, a pilot flying over Cherry Valley in East Belfast reported to air traffic controllers at the Belfast International Airport he saw a large, white, light, circular object moving at high speed with no sound. Now, that object reported he was traveling southwest at about 3 in the morning. No explanation for any of these 2001 sightings has ever been forthcoming. But at least they've now admitted that they did take place. Well, let's talk about MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and its Hollywood hookup. Now, if you remember the Blues Brothers movie, Elwood Blues looked like your classic man in black. Black suit, black fedora, black shades. In Coneheads, he played the displaced alien Beldar, making hilarious and sometimes pointed commentary on human foibles. Beldar and the Coneheads were a comical product of the early Saturday Night Live days. But to Dan Aykroyd, Canadian-born actor, aliens are no laughing matter. Now, the Aykroyd is also known for his role in the 1984 paranormal hit Ghostbuster, as he's been very open about his belief in UFOs for years, publicly supporting organizations like MUFON and using his Hollywood resources to make certain the truth gets out there. His latest effort, which is entitled Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, can actually be viewed online and claims to contain some of the most convincing UFO footage to date. Now, not all interviewers or fans take Aykroyd's devotion to UFO research as seriously as he does. Aykroyd, who's won an Emmy and is nominated for a prestigious Academy Award, takes it in stride, never faltering in his conviction that there's more to the stars than a Hollywood Walk of Fame. However, it is interesting to note that a lot of information that has come out in the various films actually has a counterpart, if you will, in actual government secrets. From UFOs and MUFON and Hollywood, let's go to Solomon. You know, according to biblical stories, King Solomon was the wisest of men, successor of the much-loved King David, who, according to his press release, slew the giant Goliath with a single well-placed stroke of his slingshot. Solomon was actually credited with many wonders. In fact, it was King Solomon who was said to have designed and built the Temple of Jerusalem, which ultimately became the receptacle of the Ark of the Covenant, which was said to be designed to allow communication with God. Now, a lot of myths have grown up around King Solomon's work with the temple. The Knights Templars, first established in 1118 AD, took their name from Solomon's temple. They made their base on the Temple Mount, a rumor to be seeking lost treasures and artifacts hidden beneath the ruins of the temple. And the Freemasons, of course, claimed connection to the Templars, but also to the Masons who labored to actually build King Solomon's temple. Their mythic figure, Hiram Abiff, may actually have historic roots in King Hiram of Tyre, foreign ruler who provided money and materials to Solomon for the construction of his very costly and very elaborate temple. Now, if an extra-biblical text is to be believed, King Hiram wasn't the only person helping Solomon build his legendary temple. In the pseudo-epigraphical Testament of Solomon, sometimes called Wisdom of Solomon, which is written between the 1st and 4th centuries A.D., King Solomon conscripts demons as slave labor for the temple project. Now, the document was actually written in Greek, in a writing style reminiscent of the New Testament, and it describes how a young worker favored by King Solomon was beset by a demon. And this demon, whose name was Ornias, preyed upon the young worker, causing the boy to waste away. When Solomon learned of this unusual predation, he prayed day and night for the Lord God to deliver the demon into his power. According to the Testament of Solomon, the Archangel Michael himself finally appeared and gave Solomon a ring bearing a seal said to be a pentagram. And according to the story, this ring from God gave Solomon the power of the demons that dwelled in the earth and preyed upon mankind. The Testament of Solomon, said to have been written by Solomon himself, claims to record for posterity the names and the offices of these demons, as well as the angels that have the power to command and bind them. Well, with this heavenly gift in his hand, Solomon wasted no time. Ornias was the first demon to be bound. Solomon not only stopped the demon from preying on the young worker, he saw fit to punish the demon by commanding him to perform menial labor for the construction of the temple. With the help of the demon, Solomon then called up demon after demon, including Asmodeus, Beelzebub, and even Lilith. He questioned each and learned the angel that held power over him and commanded him in the name of his God to bend their powers to lowly tasks such as cutting Theban marble, mixing clay for bricks, cutting and carrying wood. Now, of course, the demons weren't too thrilled with these chores, but they were powerless to resist as long as Solomon had the ring conferred by God. Now, it's actually doubtful the Temple of Jerusalem was actually constructed with the aid of demons. But the Temple of Solomon remains a very compelling tale in its treatment of demonic entities, in particular the methods of calling and binding, laid the foundation for traditions of ceremonial magic that developed in the Middle Ages and actually may have helped to inspire the Islamic belief in jinn. So you have to ask yourself, is there anything to it? I've heard many, many stories over the years, and in many cases, the people telling me these stories are absolutely assured they're telling me the truth. Well, I've mentioned Charles Fort before. He's probably the most famous champion of the bazaar. He spent his working hours combing newspaper articles and other reports to demonstrate just how commonplace the strange and the bizarre actually can be. His extensive documentation of phenomena such as rains of fish and mysterious disappearances, the inexplicable appearance of exotic animals in places they had no right to be, helped lend this unorthodox newsman's name to all things Fortean. Perhaps one of the most strange cases reported in his book entitled Lo, that's L-O, exclamation point, involves a sudden profusion of ladybirds that invaded England during the summer of 1869. According to Fort, that summer had seen a notable decrease in insect life, possibly due to a drought. And then quite suddenly, swarms of ladybirds descended on England from across the English Channel. Now, the city of Ramsgate was hit first, and the influx of bugs was so profuse that they actually lay in great drifts throughout the streets. So the people of Ramsgate had to develop a new job description, ladybird shoveler. And after Ramsgate, ladybirds descended on Dover, Kent, Surrey, Shrewsbury, even London. These bugs flew in by the millions, pelting against windows like living hail and enveloping built in a crawling spotted mammal. Invasion was reported in newspapers like the London Times and the London Standard, as well as magazines such as Land and Water and Field. And although the swarms of ladybirds seemed to consistently come inland from across waters if traveling from France to Belgium, there are actually no concurrent reports of swarms in either of these countries. Now, this led Fort to conjecture the bugs were somehow slipping into our reality over the English Channel in mid-flight, so to speak. And perhaps adding to this theory of an insectile alien invasion is the fact that the actual species of bug puzzled experts. Now, they were clearly related to English ladybirds, and yet the swarming insects tended to be yellow with a greater profusion of spots. And they were also significantly larger than the native species of ladybirds that were known in England at the time. Well, by the end of summer, the swarms of bugs were gone as inexplicably as they had come. And it only remained for the newly designated ladybird slaughterers to gather up their putrid carcasses and commit them to the fire. And eventually the entire invasion was a thing of history. If you've ever been to cemeteries and taken photographs, quite often you're lucky enough to get a photograph of an orb. And orb photos are trotted out on nearly every paranormal site as proof that ghosts exist. And these mostly translucent spheres of light appear singly or in swarms, according to some paranormal investigators. Each orb is photographic evidence of the presence of a ghost. Now, where ghost hunters are concerned, orbs are like a religion. There are those who fervently believe that every single orb in the photo is actually a ghost, smiling pretty for the camera. On the other side of the question are the disbelievers, and they're just as staunch. Disbelievers argue the orbs are nothing but motes in the camera's eye, flecks of moisture and bits of dust. And yet, of all the thousands of orb photos that get posted on ghost hunting sites across the internet, there remains those one or two compelling images. Orbs that seem to be three-dimensional. Orbs that glow with a strangely colored light. Orbs that move in reference to the other figures in the image. So the question becomes, what are orbs? We all just become floating balls of light once we move to the great beyond? Well, as interesting as that concept might be, it seems unlikely, and photos literally sprinkle with orbs, each individual dots the visual representation of a sentient spirit being. On the other hand, at least in a rare few photos, the supposed orb appears to be something other than a fleck of dust. Now, there's probably no good solution for this debate, and maybe that's what draws people to the topic over and over again. Orbs represent that special brand of compelling almost evidence that drives a continued search for ultimate proof. And because orb photos can be argued and dismissed, they keep paranormal investigators searching for that one perfect experience. Image of irrefutable proof captured on film that will make the world see and believe. Unfortunately, like so many other things, when you really see that proof, you don't have a camera handy. Well, Paul Rowland of the UK believes that cutting-edge technology is going to help us capture convincing photographic evidence of ghosts. He's the founder of Paradox Electronics, and he was inspired by sentinel detection systems that use highly sensitive sensor arrays in the conjunction of both cameras and camcorders. The sensors detect movement, but they also detect changes in electric and magnetic fields. A number of paranormal investigators believe these energetic fields are affected by the presence of spirits. Rowland's technology was put to the test during a ghost hunt at Warrington in Cheshire, and he had some intriguing results. An image that seems to glow to show a ghostly presence, possibly with two glowing eyes, was captured using his technology and strengthening the case that this is indeed photographic evidence of a ghost. The image was taken immediately following an experience by a spirit medium. And although he's understandably excited about the image, Rowland himself is cautious. He reminds ghost hunters to remain objective when gathering evidence. Even so, the wicked alchemy of his ultra-high-tech equipment may actually lead to the ultimate ghost picture. Well, from ultra-high-tech ghost hunting equipment, let's talk about phantoms and feast days. And while it may seem a bit morbid to our modern sensibilities, an old tradition hangs around the night of before the Feast of St. Mark. That's April 25th. In Yorkshire, Scarborough, Teesdale, and related locales across the English countryside, those curious to see the shades of the people fated to die in the coming year would keep vigil at the entrance of the town church. The vigil traditionally lasted for an hour. Before midnight and an hour afterward, the procession of spirits wouldn't appear unless the vigil keeper spent the full 2 hours awake and watchful. Falling asleep during the vigil was considered to have dire consequences. Far worse than merely losing the opportunity to see the solemn parade of future dead. So that any who fell asleep while keeping this vigil guaranteed themselves a place among the spirit's ranks and would also be dead within the next year. By some accounts, it was necessary to keep vigil for 3 consecutive years before the parade of phantoms would present itself to the observer. In the West Riding of Yorkshire, a variation of this practice places the date of the vigil not on St. Mark's Eve, but on the Eve of All Saints, date far more in tune with our modern sensibilities. All Saints' Day falls November 1st. This feast day, sometimes also called All Hallows, and the evening before is widely celebrated as Halloween. Now, if you're a geek of a certain age, you might have caught the short-lived Chris Carter television series Millennium. In that show, which built on a wide variety of folk beliefs and superstition, the main character and his daughter, both gifted with psychic sensibilities, arrived through happenstance at the doors of the local church, just in time to see the procession of shades on the Eve of All Saints. The All Hallows version was once recounted by an older spinster aunt who was the self-proclaimed keeper of all things Irish in her little church of Clan Mahoney. Originally came from County Cork. So the question becomes, does the spirit procession actually take place? And if so, when does it? Well, we've all heard about the UFOs associated with Roswell, New Mexico. But how about Roswell, Georgia? There, ghosts are the paranormal phenomena of choice, and members of the Roswell Ghost Tour happily tell you all about the spectral residents of their town. Located just north of Roswell, of Atlanta, Roswell, Georgia is a quaint little city with a lot of history. Overlooking the town from the highest vantage point is the serene and majestic Barrington Hall, considered to be one of the best examples of Greek Revival architecture in the U.S. Another fine antebellum edifice is Bullock Hall, a building that was once home to Mittie Bullock, the mother of 26th President Teddy Roosevelt. Now, Roswell will be worth a visit for all the history waiting to be discovered along its quiet streets, but the town also seems to have a high penchant for paranormal phenomenon. Deanna Avina and her husband Joe, the owners of the tour, both longtime Roswell residents whose own ghostly experiences inspired their involvement in the tour. Being avid ghost hunters, the Avinas pursue their spectral neighbors through a combination of technology and intuitive perceptions. They get a lot of encouragement from their living neighbors who regularly volunteer stories of their own ghostly encounters in that haunted town. Avoiding cheesy stunts or theatrics that so many tours do take part in, the Roswell Ghost Tour relies on the ghosts themselves to add spice to their nightly excursions. And judging by the number of intuitive perceptions, EVPs, and weird photographs generated from the tour, the Roswell ghostly inhabitants seem to be very cooperative. For 20 years, I did a ghost tour here in El Paso, and El Paso is, by my estimation, the most haunted city in the country. And I've got some photographs that absolutely would blow your mind. Well, from Roswell, Georgia, let's go to Lakeview Cemetery outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Now, Lakeview Cemetery is a 285-acre final resting place tucked away in the rolling wooded hills of Cleveland. Expertly sculpted by Herman Matson in 1923, the nearly life-size angel with outspread wings sits enthroned above the plot of Francis Henry Hasserot and his wife Sarah. Scarred by pollution and the passing of the years, the angel's face has undergone eerie change and appears to be weeping black tears. And this quirk alone would render the monument imposing in the very least. And yet local ghost hunters insist there's more to Cleveland's angel of death than simple artistry. Individual name of Psychic Sonia, who runs Cleveland's haunted tours, has mentioned the Hasserot angel when discussing some of the more haunted places in Cleveland. Mike the Ritchie, a coordinator of Cleveland's Paranormal Roundtables, visited the angel several times. In his opinion, there's definitely something paranormal about that statue. He said, I could feel the hairs raising on my arms as I approached it. And when I touched it, my hand came away tingling. It's truly an eerie encounter. Another psychic who has experienced the spirit of the grim monuments, the young Sarah Davis. While attending the College of Worcester, Davis led ghost tours in Wayne County, considered by many to be the most haunted county in Ohio. And when the Hazarot Angel was brought to her attention, she identified the statue as no ordinary haunting. Rather than perceiving a human spirit, Davis felt that an entity had come to inhabit the statue itself. The spirit being, in her opinion, was definitely not human, although she didn't feel it was evil. He said, referring to the spirit in the statue, she said that he's beautiful, but so sad. Now, the angel was commissioned by Francis Henry Hazarot, who died in 1953. He wanted it to watch over the grave of his wife, Sarah, who died in 1920. Sarah was very dear to Francis, and he remained a widower until his own death, more than 30 years after her death. If Davis is correct, neither Francis nor his wife linger in spirit at the grave, then what does haunt that somber-faced statue? Well, the massive bronze angel remains impassive as it silently guards the Hazarot family graves. It keeps its own secrets well. Well, from haunted statues, let's talk about biblical bloodsuckers. And I don't mean the IRS. We all know, thanks to Bram Stoker, that Count Dracula swept under our popular imagination just a little over 100 years ago. But vampires were a subject of fiction and myth long before Dracula came on the scene. Writers like Lord Byron, Joseph LaFanu, and even Samuel Taylor Coleridge all turned their pens to the vampire tale at least once. Their writing, in turn, was inspired by vampire epidemics reportedly happened throughout Eastern Europe in the 17th and 18th century. But how old are vampires, really? Our modern image of the vampire owes a great deal to the folkloric vampires of Eastern Europe. But the concept of vampires may be far older than the Transylvanian corpses said to be wandering the countryside. Even the Bible seems to have one or two vampire-like creatures lurking in its pages. If you go to Proverbs chapter 30, verses 14 through 16, this discusses a race of people whose teeth are swords and whose fangs are knives. They prey on the needy and the poor, and they're compared to the Aluka, which is a type of horse leech. Now, these biblical bloodsuckers are most likely meant to be a metaphor for mean-spirited and predatory people, but the passage in Proverbs seems to present them quite seriously. Considering that the Nephilim, mentioned briefly in Genesis, are also said to drink blood, vampires may be a far older and stranger breed of beings than we actually give them credit for. They may actually exist. Well, from biblical vampires, let's talk about the demons of Dr. Faust. Now, Dr. Faustus summoned the demon, and it made a great theater. On English stages, at the same time actors performed Shakespeare at the Globe, Dr. Faustus called upon the demon Mephistopheles and made a pact to trade his immortal soul. And the playwright Kit Marlowe certainly embellished many aspects of the Faust myth, but much like his contemporary William Shakespeare, he drew core elements of his tale from beliefs, legends, and real practices of the time. Now, Marlowe was writing in the early 1600s, which was a heated time in Europe for both demonology and witchcraft. Johann Weyer, the student of Agrippa mentioned in an earlier show, published his landmark work on the belief in demons and witchcraft in 1563, and it was still in circulation when Marlowe sat down to write his opus. The Pseudomonarchia Daemonum, or False Monarchy of Demons, was an appendix famously circulated from Weyer's larger work, making clear reference to the art of summoning spirits in addition to describing the extensive false monarchy of the demons themselves. Unlike Mephistopheles and Dr. Faustus, the spirits of the Pseudomonarchia Daemonum are not presented as beings of fiction. Myers wrote his entire opus as a response to the widespread belief in demons, witches, and black magic that gripped Europe in his day. We know the period is the witch trials or the witch craze, a sociological phenomenon that lasted from the 14th through the 17th century. At the time Wire did his writings, individuals all over Europe were being rounded up, tortured, and executed on allegations that they were involved in witchcraft. The vast majority of those condemned in these trials were accused of forming a pact and literally making a deal with the devil, typically for supernatural power. But if they had the supernatural power, couldn't they have defeated their captors? Deal often hinged on a supposed witch's ability to summon infernal spirits in order to initiate the pact. Now, in hindsight, we know that the witch allegations were founded primarily in hysteria and prejudice. Women, outsiders, and religious minorities were frequent targets of the witch finders, and it was an added bonus for these zealous Christian soldiers if an accused witch's property could be lawfully seized and redistributed to the witch finder's friends. Majority of confessions were obtained under the cruelest of torture, and if a pre-Christian magical tradition persisted in Europe among the rural populace, the waters so incredibly muddy by the Baroque imaginings put forth in texts such as the Melius Maleficum that sorted the true cunning men and women from their unfortunate counterparts had been rendered almost impossible. What we can say about the period of the witch trials is this. There were no devil sabbats, no profane kisses planted on the hindquarters of black goats, and no demonic pacts the likes of which inquisitors dreamed about. But the belief that spirits could be summoned and exorcised, abjured, controlled, compelled, well, these beliefs persisted as a far older tradition than the beliefs cooked up for the witch trials themselves. You know, quite clearly, a lot of the allegations were made to enrich the witch finders. Well, ever since the 1973 blockbuster The Exorcist, Ouija boards have been viewed with near universal suspicion. Depicted at best as risky portals to the spirit realm, or at worst as overt tools of the devil, this patented game of spirit communication has been centered in many tales of harrowing hauntings. But Ouija boards didn't always have a negative reputation. And although the lettered boards certainly had their detractors throughout the 19th and early 20th century, they were viewed by many as safe and valuable tools for spirit communication. Named in 1890 at a rooming house in Baltimore by Helen Peters, the Ouija board was awarded a U.S. patent the following year under the auspices of her brother. Similar lettered boards had existed prior to this point, possibly going back as far as the 1840s. In fact, Victor Hugo, who lived from 1802 to 1885, made extensive use of a lettered board to communicate with spirits, including everybody from Dante to Moses. Till the Peters family came along, however, nobody had thought to get a patent for the game. American entrepreneur William Fudd soon took over the Peters family business. It was his savvy marketing of Ouija boards and national mail-order catalogs that made these turn-of-the-century items take off. As spiritualism was all the rage in the English-speaking world at the time, Ouija boards quickly became must-have items for every medium's parlor and local psychical society. Boards were used to communicate with dead loved ones, but more than that, they're often used to communicate with deceased celebrities. In the 1910s and 20s, channel books proliferated, each supposedly written through the use of a Ouija board. Many of those were credited as the post-mortem creations of famous authors, to include Mark Twain, or Samuel Clemens, as most people know him. Emily Grant Hutchins, a woman from Twain's hometown of Hannibal, Missouri, believed herself to be the chosen conduit for his postmortem works. Introduction to her 1917 novel, Jap Heron, she recounts her first encounter with Twain through the medium of Ouija board. Out of idle curiosity, she had attended the meeting of a local psychical society, only to have Twain come through on the board and begin asking for her. When she and the other sitters expressed skepticism about the spirit's request to have her start writing new books for him, he directed the group to check their records from 1911. 6 years prior to any contact with Hutchins, Twain had previously come through on the board's group's Ouija board, declaring his desire to continue his writing career, but only if the right living person came along to transcribe his words. Well, based on this flimsiest of evidence, Hutchins was convinced she was the right person and she worked to transmit what she believed were the creative works of Mark Twain from beyond the grave. And she wasn't the only person who held this belief. Sarah Taylor Shatford, writing in 1919, published Shakespeare's Revelations by Shakespeare's Spirit. That was another book purportedly dictated to a living writer through a Ouija board. That same year, Catherine Marden Davis published Light from Beyond, a fictionalized spiritualist treatise that also come through in a series of Ouija board sessions over the course of 3 weeks. Others claimed to communicate and faithfully transcribe works of writers and poets and philosophers, including Shelley, Wordsworth, Voltaire, and Poe. Even Victor Hugo, who had himself nearly a century before communicated with the spirits of the dead, was sought out to continue his work from beyond the grave. Well, it raises interesting questions when you talk about transcribing things that come through Ouija boards. Is it your subconscious talking, or is it the real spirit? Then we have the question, is vampirism a condition that exists outside of folklore and film? Are there real living people who psychically feed on human life force or even on blood? What's the source of these supernatural hungers? Well, something called the Atlanta Vampire Alliance has the answers. Formed in 2005, the Atlanta Vampire Alliance is a research group devoted to the modern condition of vampirism. But Dracula would never recognize these vampires as kin. And you see, the vampires of the AVA, as it's called, are living human beings, often psychic, who have a need for life force of others. And they've come together as a group to study and better understand that need. Now, this is no fly-by-night venture, if you'll excuse the pun. The AVA's Vampire and Energy Work Research Survey circulated to thousands of self-identified vampires and energy workers around the world as hundreds of questions focusing on everything from the individual's religious belief to the minute details of their medical history. AVA's goal is to gather hard statistics about real vampires, statistics that they hope will ultimately be taken seriously in an academic context. And part of this goal has actually been achieved. Featured in the recent release, Vampires in Their Own Words, the AVA's also worked with several individuals attached to colleges as part of what's called, laughingly, academic research. Most recently, they started working with author Rosemary Ellen Gelley to help add their knowledge to the 2008 re-release of her landmark work, Vampires Among Us. The ongoing research at the AVA may well change the way vampirism is defined. Well, we've covered a lot of topics today, and we've talked in detail about a number of issues. But I want to close today's show, because we're just about out of time, with the urging, if you need assistance in getting documents served, I recommend you go and see the good people at Cherokee Process Servers. Now the Well, nothing wants to cooperate. There we go. Now you can find them, and it's a better known business, which I believe is very important. Because a lot of companies take advantage of veterans, especially the roofers I've been fighting with for 7 years. They have, they believe veterans are there to be taken advantage of, and there's all kinds of free VA money, and they're standing there with their hands out, and they think keeping the pressure on using crooked attorneys is the way to get that VA ATM to start coughing up money. Well, I don't agree. And if you have needs of assistance, it's Cherokee Process Servers, 1002 McGoffin Avenue in El Paso, Texas, 915-239-3736. Their hours are 8 to 5. So I recommend, if you have need, call them and tell them you heard about them on the show. Until tomorrow at this time, Monday at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.